Holman in his home at his home in West Salem, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is 2/27/98, and this is tape 12, side one. Go ahead about what you were talking about decisions by the court.
I don't remember now what the prior discussion was. We
Okay.
were talking off the record
Right.
About somebody talking about legal fallacies. Well, of course, there are certain legal fallacies, and as a rule, we cover those fallacies up by not laying down a rule, but submitting them to the jury. In other words, let me give you an example. We talk about negligence. And negligence is the doing of that, or the not doing of that, which a reasonable, prudent man would do under the same or similar circumstances. Who the hell knows what that is? It may mean one thing to you. It may mean another thing to me. It'll mean still something else to someone else. Well, we laid down which seems like a fine rule, but it's no rule at all, because it just leaves it up to the individual people who are trying that case as to whether they think the result is reasonable or whether they don't, or the whether the actions of a person were reasonable or whether they were not. And negligence is not capable of a definition, and we have people who think that all people who are, we all ought to pay so much money, and all people who are injured ought to receive a certain amount, whether it's by accident or otherwise, and that we would be better off to put it into a bureaucracy and have them do that. There are other people who believe that it's all right the way we're doing it because people have an instinct for what's reasonable and what isn't reasonable, and we ought to leave it up to that. But it's incapable of a rule. Mm-hmm. So we cover that up by stating a general rule, which really doesn't mean anything.
Well, going back to what we were talking about before, do you think that it's important for people in the legal profession, for judges, to have informal contacts with one another, bar association meetings and conferences, judicial conferences and things like that? Do you think that these are important for judges in the evolution of their own philosophy or...
Oh, I don't think it's tremendously important one way or the other. I think that you have to have some connection with lawyers and keep your irons in the fire if you want to continue to hold the job. But I don't think it has makes a whole lot of difference as to how judges decide things.
What's been the nature of your association with the ABA and the Oregon Bar Associations?
I was a member of the American Bar Association at one time. Of course, I had to be a member of the local Oregon Bar in order to practice. I served principally in the Oregon Bar upon the Committee for Judicial Administration. As a matter of fact, this was why the court selected me to try and draw a plan for the Court of Appeals, because I was the only member of the court that was a member of that committee. And of course, whoever drew the plan had to sell it to the Bar Committee on Judicial Administration as a start. And I'm sure I was selected for that reason. I served on a legislative interim committee on the administration of justice, which was established by the 55 legislature. I was the, while I was active in it, so far as other matters are concerned, I was the chairman of the subcommittee that was in charge of juvenile law, and we wrote a whole new juvenile act, or established a plan for one. We didn't write the actual statutes ourselves.
Were you a member of any other judicial or legal associations?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm. And in general, what's the hardest part of your job? The hardest part of your job. What was the overall? What would you say was the hardest part of being a judge on the Supreme Court?
Well, being a trial judge has certain things that are difficult. Supreme Court may have another things that are difficult. I think the hardest part was the long hours. The amount of time that I had to expend in order to do a halfway adequate job. I'm sure I must have averaged 60 hours a week or in excess, because I worked virtually every night and every weekend, and most of the other judges on the court did too. And I think it was just exhaustive insofar as the amount of time that was involved. If you're a trial judge, you got a whole different situation.
And what did you enjoy most about being a judge?
Pardon?
What did you enjoy most about being a judge and about your career? Was there a certain aspect of it that you enjoyed more than anything else?
I enjoyed the writing part of being a Supreme Court judge more than any other part of it. I don't think I was particularly good at it, but I enjoyed trying to set down an exact idea in a form that was easily understandable to somebody that would be persuasive. I don't think I was particularly good at it. I think my English was deficient, but I surrounded myself by people who were not deficient in that respect and who could clean up what I did. It's best to know your own failings. As a trial judge, everybody enjoys the authority, I suppose. That's just human. And you're playing God with people's lives, and some of that's real difficult. I found that so far as the trial work was concerned, that I did in connection with children and juvenile work, and I was in a place where originally I was the only judge there and I had to do everything, I found this particularly trying. It was difficult for me because I could see that the children that were in difficulty were the result of their environment, and I couldn't do anything to change their environment. All you could do was take them away from their parents and hope that change of environment might help, but you can't take all children away from their parents. This is just not practical. And I felt that I was fighting a losing battle and that I really wasn't accomplishing very much.
Go ahead.
Pardon?
Go ahead.
No.
What effect did being a judge have on your social life? I mean, aside from the fact that you had to work
so many
hours.
As long as I was a trial judge, I didn't let it interfere with my social life. I continued to associate with the lawyers I'd associated before, and I lived no differently than I would have under other circumstances, and I made an effort not to change it. As a Supreme Court judge, I didn't have any time for any social life.
How did...
Not only that, I moved to a new community at the age of 50, and you don't start making friends much after the age of 50. You've got... you don't have kids in the school system, so you don't get acquainted there. And your time is fully occupied in any event, and you just don't have time for much social life when you're on the Supreme Court in any event.
Was your wife fairly understanding of your situation?
Yes, she was, and she suffered by it, I'm sure. When I would come home at night and work, she had to remain quiet and leave me alone, because you can't carry on a conversation with somebody and work at the same time. When I work on weekends, the same thing was true. She was pretty much isolated because I couldn't act as a husband's supposed to act. She didn't have the communication with me that you would normally have, and this was difficult for her.
Was she involved in other activities?
Not in Salem. She was somewhere. I was a trial judge, but not here, because she came here late in life too, and this didn't make it easy for her.
So how did she spend her time then?
My wife was basically an intellectual. She was interested in everything. She was smart. I don't know. I don't know. She was smarter than I. I went to law school with her, and her grades were better than mine. She didn't finish law school because there was really no position for a woman in law much at that time. She quit law school and went 2 years to read. Then we were married when I was graduated from law school. Up until the time we both went into the service, she worked all the time. I think she was happier working. And when I came back from the service, there was no need for her to work any longer, and I discouraged her working, and I'm sure I made a mistake, because I think she'd been happier if she had continued to be gainfully occupied. Not because she needed the money, but it kept her doing something. She occupied her time with doing such things as, on her own, figuring out musical theory and things like this, which are tremendously difficult. I would guess that she probably had an IQ of at least 160.
Did she have any outlets for all these intellectual interests?
She was an intellectualist. She just wanted to know. She didn't particularly want to do anything with him, but she wanted to know. I always told her that she should have been married to a college professor, because she would have taken every damn course in that college. She enjoyed going to school. She was interested in a multiplicity of things. Her reading was omnivorous. She didn't care for fashion or for clothes or for parties or anything like that. All the things she was interested in was books, primarily.
So she spent most of her days then reading and things like that?
She was became partially isolated for other reasons. At age 50, she became an insulin diabetic. and occasionally would have an insulin reaction, which embarrassed her mightily. It's just like being drunk, or at least that's the way you appear to other people. Mm-hmm. Also, she began having problems that we could not account for. I would come home and I would find her in distress, and she would say, "You know, I was working out in the yard today, and all of a sudden, everything was different for just an instant." And I could see she was disturbed about this. It came to fruition in 1964 at Thanksgiving time. My mother and her companion were coming for dinner, Thanksgiving Day dinner. And Thanksgiving Day, in the morning, my wife had put the turkey in the oven and whatnot, and I was laying in bed reading. And pretty soon she called to me and she said, "Ralph, what day is this?" And I said, "What in hell are you talking about?" And she says, I said, "You know what day it is." And she says, no, "I'm serious. What day is it?" And I could tell she was disturbed. And I said, "Well, you damn fool, you know it's Thanksgiving, don't you?" And she says, "No. Is today Thanksgiving?" And I said, "Go look and see what's in the oven." She had no memory of putting the turkey in there, or no memory of what day it was. She had had an epileptic seizure. As a result of this, I sent her down to medical school. My brother was dean of the medical school. And she was put through a course of sprouts by the head of that department. She happened to go down there, and a doctor saw her that, in talking to my brother afterwards, I could sense that he thought we'd seen the wrong guy, even though we'd seen the head of the department, a man who he subsequently got rid of and got somebody in their place. The guy could not diagnose her. They were talking about cutting nerves and an operation and all this sort of stuff. And I was not for that. But about that time, my brother got rid of the head of the department and hired a Japanese doctor. Not Japanese, he's American, but of Japanese heritage, from the California system, the University of San Francisco. And he diagnosed her within the first week of seeing her. She had a melanoma, which is a form of tumor which grows between the lining of the inside the skull, between the lining of the brain and the skull. It doesn't actively entwine its tendrils into the brain, but it takes up space and puts pressure on the brain. Melanoma is not the right word. That's for skin cancer. I've forgotten the word now. But it's a particular kind of cancer. Not cancer, it's not a cancerous thing, it's a particular kind of growth, a tumor. As a result, she was operated on in when she was in, oh, I suppose she was past 60 years of age when she was operated on. Things did not go well at first. She could neither talk nor write. And the doctor said, well, this could only be caused by one thing, and that's pressure. That means there has to be fluid in the cavity that's pressing on her brain. And the answer to that is we can go through the hole we made in the skull and withdraw that. And they did it in the hospital while I was there, did it right in the room. And what he was done, he said, well, I didn't get an amount of fluid which I thought would put the kind of pressure that she's obviously having on her. And I thought, oh my God, how better she died on the operating table than have this happen, because this means she can't read, she can't talk and make sense. She can't write. And I could tell by looking at her that she was fully intelligent, but that she could just couldn't function. All of a sudden, she couldn't function. I came back to Salem and tried to work the next morning, and I couldn't do it. I finally left, and I arrived at the hospital at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And as I walked through the door, she said, I can read, I can write. And I said, what happened? She says, I don't know, but about 11 o'clock, it was just like somebody had put up the window blind, all of a sudden I can function. This did not keep her from continuing to have seizures. She's now got two things. She's taking insulin as a diabetic. She's taking seizure medicine, but it's not effective. Even after the tumor was taken out, her brain, it had been there for such a long time. The doctor said it had been growing for 25 years. And I could account for a lot of things that I couldn't account for otherwise now. The doctor who operated on her was on the hospital staff, and she said to him after the operation and after she was over it, she said, doctor, are you sure you got it all? He looked at her and he says, what the hell do you care? It took 25 years to get that way, and you don't have 25 years more. which was pretty blunt, but which we both appreciated. In other words, he was giving us a pure scoop. But it really didn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. They'd relieved all the pressure they could, and there wasn't time for the thing to grow again. Mm-hmm. It was about almost as big as an egg.
Gee.
But this tended to isolate her, because she could get a seizure at any time. I can think of an occasion she went to lunch with a friend of hers, and all of a sudden she looks at her friend sitting across the table and says, who are you? Well, seizures had that effect. They impaired her memory, which would come back gradually for a period of about an hour, and then she'd be all right, and then she'd remember things. But it gradually affected her long-term memory. I found that she was doing things that would recall things to her, like we'd go to Europe, and every day she would write what we did. And she'd write it in the form of a letter that she sent to somebody. But when she came back, she got that letter from the person I know now it was to, so she could remember what had occurred. She would meet people on the street that she should have known, and she would not remember them. Well, this isolated her, particularly when I was working 10 hours, 60 hours a week. She couldn't drive anymore.
Because she might have a seizure?
Oh, yeah, because she might have a seizure, either an insulin reaction or a seizure. Her father had had an insulin reaction and had been in the hospital, and he came to our house to recover afterwards, and he never left because he could no longer really take care of himself. And in a good thing, this was good for my wife because it gave her company at home. He lived with us 13 years before he died. He died right where you're sitting. He just keeled over with a heart attack. And when I die, that's the way I want to die. She wouldn't go any place unless I was with her.
But didn't her medicine control, the insulin medicine that she was taking, or the anticonvulsant that she was taking, that didn't control the situation?
It didn't control the seizures. Even before or after the operation. Her brain had been permanently deformed by the thing, and she was too old for it to recuperate. She became isolated and a hermit. In other words, she couldn't leave here except with me because she couldn't drive. And she had a few friends that would come and see her, but other than this, she just didn't see people anymore much unless she was with me. And I didn't have the time until I retired. And it was extremely difficult for her.
So what happened after your retirement then?
What happened after our retirement? We traveled extensively. We both enjoyed it. And finally, her diabetes got so that it had affected her heart. And she didn't have the stamina to get through airports. And then we didn't travel by airplane anymore, but we traveled around some considerable by automobile. Because this is the way she traveled best then. I've been lucky all my life. Marriage is a gamble. Nobody really knows whether or not they'll get along with their husband or wife until they're married and actually try it. And we had our rough times because she was raised in a family which was run by her mother, and I was raised in a family which was run by my father, and we saw our jobs in a different light, and this caused some knocking off of the corners, but we had a good marriage, and when you have a good marriage, that's lucky.
Did you ever regret not having children?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest The biggest problem in the world today, in my opinion, is overpopulation. And I don't think the world is going to be any worse off because I didn't have any children.
So I guess then, since we're talking about this, then how did this all play out with her in the end?
She, the diabetes eventually destroyed her immune system, and she had pneumonia repetitively, and pretty soon the drugs wore out, which were the answer to pneumonia, and when that happened, she got pneumonia and died.